I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is author Colm Tobin, and now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Colm Tobin.
It's one of the most famous Greek tragedies, a powerful king who sacrifices his daughter to the gods, a vengeful wife who then murders him, their children who, in turn, commit matricide. The blood-soaked story of Agamemnon, Clytemnestra, Iphigenia, Electra, and Orestes is creatively reimagined and reanimated across the millennia in acclaimed Irish author Colm Tobin's new book, House of Names. In the review of the book by the Washington Post, they write, quote, "Never before has Tobin demonstrated such range, not just in tone, but in action. He creates the arresting, hushed scenes for which he's so well known, just as effectively as he whips up murders that compete pint for spilled pint with those immortal Greek playwrights." Colm Tobin is the author of 7 novels, including The Master, winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, Brooklyn, winner of the Costa Book Award, The Testament of Mary, and Nora Webster, as well as 2 story collections. Let's give him a warm welcome to the JCC.
Thank you very much. Over the last few years, I have been subletting an apartment each year from different people, and it's fascinating. You know, it's nice to get to sleep in other people's beds without having them in the bed as well, you know. But I think the most interesting part actually are what people's books, the books people have, and the fact that over 3 months, no matter what happens, you end up taking something down that you yourself would not normally read. And a few years ago, I looked at a list, at a whole lot of books about American history, and they included the biographies of Lyndon Johnson by Robert Caro. And I know about Robert Caro because, and I actually met him once, and I said to him, "You know, you did more damage to my country than Cromwell." And he said, "I've never been in your country. I don't know. I've not done any damage to your country." And I said, "Well, what happened was that one Irish politician who really was interested in graft and corruption and getting, you know, all sorts of deals done came to America, found one of those early biographies about Lyndon Johnson down in Texas, what he did, all the deals he made, brought it back to Ireland, and then ordered it by the box load, gave it to every politician in his party." And so that for a decade, we lived in Ireland with every politician. You would ask someone, "Why did you do what you did last week?" "Caro." He said, "It's in Caro." And so that the sort of shadow of Robert Caro was all over Ireland. But the book that I paid particular attention to is the book, The Passage to Power, which is really the story of Johnson becoming president. And I was reading particularly that section from the time he's appointed vice president and Robert Kennedy sort of takes against him. And then once Kennedy's elected, the Kennedys don't want really him around much. He's always sitting outside the office with Evelyn Lincoln stopping him getting inside. And then the assassination occurs and he becomes president. And then this extraordinary scene that Caro describes with such care of him suddenly realizing who he's going to become. And he has a wonderful description of him silently in the corner of a room, just thinking. And then you have he's thinking about the Civil Rights Acts, the things he's going to put through, how well he knows the Senate, how well he knows Congress. In a way, he's a great lesson. His story is a great lesson to everybody. And then it comes to the reader knowing that, that Johnson is going to, doesn't know that it's the Vietnam War is going to be his undoing, as Robert Kennedy in turn doesn't know what's coming, you know, that that in other words, he in turn will be assassinated at, as his brother. But as I was reading these pages, and I was thinking, you know, is there a novel as good as this? And people were talking about all these TV series, but I can't watch TV. You know, people were talking about The Wire and Game of Cards and House of Thrones, all sorts of things. But I just couldn't. I just couldn't understand anything anyone was saying and stuff. Even I watched one of them with subtitles, and even that was no help. So I began to think about that because at the time I was writing a novel called Nora Webster, and the novel is set in the southeast of Ireland in the late 1960s, and really nothing at all happens in the book. I mean, I made a joke about the book, but it wasn't such a joke that it was Madame Bovary with no Madame and no Bovary. You know, that in other words, that it's not as though there's any adultery or anything like that happening in this small town in the southeast of Ireland. And I mean, the nearest thing to an adventure is when Nora Webster goes out. It's a year after her husband dies, and she goes out to a gramophone society, which, you know, people play classical music as they all sort of gather in a ring. And that was the nearest thing to adventure. And I was trying to make drama out of this, but I was feeling oddly guilty. Oh, why doesn't she win the lottery or go to America or something happened to her? But I thought, no, I have to stick to this. I've made rules about this novel, that this novel is about this sort of strange new way in which someone has been lost her anchor in a place, trying to rebuild her life. And but nonetheless, it was on my mind as well because I interrupted the writing of Nora Webster to write The Testament of Mary, which is the story, which is, I mean, rather more exciting, in fact, of Mary, the mother of Jesus. That was performed in the theatre a number of times by a number of different actresses. And I became a sort of stage door Johnny. You know, I just couldn't keep away from the actresses. And there was one actress in Spain, Blanca Portillo, was playing the part. And she said to the director one night, could that writer guy, the guy who wrote this, could just get him to go to the back seat some night? Because every time I come out as the mother of Jesus, he's just staring at me with his mouth wide open, you know? And afterwards, you know, because it was hot, she did it in the summer in Spain, she would want to go for beers, and I'd always be the guy who would take her for beers and sit watching her, you know, trying to soak in the sort of energy that she had been exuding. I was trying to get some of it too. So that all of that led to this story. Fiona Shaw had played the part of Mary in New York and in London, and I mean, she was talking about just other stories to write. And I mean, she wasn't suggesting, I think she didn't want me to write it for her or for the theatre. I think she thought she'd had enough of me, really, in the theatre. You know, she'd had to learn my lines and, you know, it was hard. And she put it into my mind to look at this story. And when I looked at the story of the Oresteia and began to read different translations, I read it, the introductions to those books, some of which are so bad, so boring, so dull that you'd wonder if they ever had read any Greek theatre, the people who wrote the introductions. But some of them are so brilliant. Anne Carson's especially are so well written, those introductions. But they specifically mentioned a play called Iphigenia in Aulis, which is a play that I hadn't read. And I thought I should go. I'm at that age where if I, you know, when I was younger, it wouldn't bother me if I hadn't read something. But I worry now about not reading things. So I went and read it. And it changes everything because it gives you the story from Clytemnestra's point of view. That so much of the time, the center of the Oresteia is taken up by Electra. And Electra has all the power on the stage. All the light is coming towards her and her rage and her way of expressing her rage against her mother and her waiting for her brother to return so that they can retaliate against her mother for her mother's killing of their father, Agamemnon. And it takes you back. It's a late play written by Euripides, and it is as though almost at the end of his life he sought to make up for all the damage they had all done to Clytemnestra, making her this sort of monster mother. to actually see things from her side. And from her side, it's simple that before the Trojan Wars begin, Agamemnon, King Agamemnon, the house of Atreus, he realizes that the winds are not in his favor, and his boats won't sail, his ships won't sail, and he implores the gods to do something about this. And the gods say, "Yes, we will change the wind for you, but in turn, you must sacrifice your beautiful daughter Iphigenia." And so he contacts his wife, Clytemnestra, and says, "There's going to be a wedding. Bring Iphigenia. And bring the young boy, Orestes, as well, our son. And there's going to be a wedding. We're going to marry our daughter to the great warrior Achilles. And there will be celebrations." And they get all the seamstresses going, and they get all the clothes ready, and they all arrive, and it's going to be marvelous. And there's a picture for a moment of happiness of the king meeting his wife again, playing with his young son, hugging his daughter, that couldn't be more pure and beautiful. He just doesn't have the courage to tell them what he has in mind, what's going to happen. And when his wife finds out that they plan not to marry her daughter, but to kill her, to sacrifice her, she does everything to try and stop it, and it cannot be stopped. And as she watches her husband, she sees a weakness in him. She sees him as someone, he knows that he shouldn't do this, but he knows that he will. And his wife watches this, and she has utter contempt for a weakness she sees in him. In any case, she decides that if he comes back victorious from these wars, that she will be waiting for him, that she'll be ready to get him. And she plans this meticulously. What she's going to do to him. She takes a lover, Aegisthus, who's going to help her, or so she thinks, in doing this. And, of course, he comes back with Cassandra. And so she decides, actually, to get rid of Cassandra to boot, you know, just to throw Cassandra into the pot as well. And just this opening bit I'm going to read is her. She's rather pleased with herself because she's succeeded. She's actually done the deed. And it was difficult. And a great amount of planning and strategy went into it. He's dead, and Cassandra is dead. And this is Clytemnestra. "I have been acquainted with the smell of death, the sickly, sugary smell that wafted in the wind towards the rooms in this palace. It is easy now for me to feel peaceful and content. I spend my morning looking at the sky and the changing light. The bird song begins to rise as the world fills with its own pleasures, and then as day wanes, the sound too wanes and fades. I watch as the shadows lengthen. So much has slipped away, but the smell of death lingers. Maybe the smell has entered my body and been welcomed there like an old friend come to visit. The smell of fear and panic. The smell is here like the very air is here. It returns in the same way as light in the morning returns. It is my constant companion. It has put life into my eyes, eyes that grew dull with waiting but are not dull now, eyes that are alive now with brightness. I gave orders that the body should remain in the open under the sun a day or two until the sweetness gave way to stench. And I liked the flies that came, their little bodies perplexed and brave, buzzing after their feast, upset by the continuing hunger they felt in themselves, a hunger I had come to know too and had come to appreciate. We're all hungry now. Food merely whets our appetite, it sharpens our teeth. Meat makes us ravenous for more meat, as death is ravenous for more death. Murder makes us ravenous, fills the soul with satisfaction that is fierce and then luscious enough to create a taste for further satisfaction. A knife piercing the soft flesh under the ear with intimacy and precision and then moving across the throat as soundlessly as the sun moves across the sky, but with greater speed and zeal, and then his dark blood flowing with the same inevitable hush as dark night falls on familiar things." And part of the problem I had after that really was what to do about the gods. There's a problem with the gods, which is that the Greek gods either have, their names are either too long or too short, or have too many vowel sounds or too many consonants or diphthongs or something. And the problem with the novel form itself, as it developed from the 18th century, is essentially a secular form. It really loves human choices and chances, human decisions, what we decide to do, people confronting their destiny. I think it's not hard to imagine how fed up we'd all be if Mr. Darcy, for example, in Pride and Prejudice, prayed to the gods the night before, and the gods told him he should go over in the morning, and they would provide him with a horse, and the horse was outside, provided by the gods, and that he should propose to Elizabeth. She was all waiting for him. She, too, had been praying through the night, and she knew he would come because the oracle had told her, he will come. And, you know, and that the gods looked with great disfavor on Lady Catherine de Bourgh, and she had in some way disobeyed the gods, and they decided to smite her. And you just feel, hold on a minute, you know, can we just get down to what did Mr. Darcy want? What were his desires? What did he want at the beginning of the book? You know, Jane Austen has a lot of fun making Lady Catherine de Bourgh into this sort of human ogre, you know, a sort of monster of a human scale. And the story must unfold, in a way where Mr. Darcy's 10,000 a year was earned, or it was never earned actually, but at least it wasn't given to him suddenly as a result of prayer or the oracle. And you know, the same too goes for Isabel Archer in Portrait of a Lady. Imagine if she prayed in Albany that her aunt would come and get her out of here, and suddenly her aunt was praying too, she would find her long lost niece. And they met suddenly. You know, it just wouldn't work. And so the thing was to get the gods out of this book at a very early stage. And the way I thought of doing this was that that Clytemnestra, in this time where she sees the damage the gods have done, she knows how wrong it is what they have done with her daughter. And she's seen it happen. And that she actually decides that she no longer believes in this. And this is her working that out. I had spies to tell me when my husband would come back. Men lit each fire that gave news to further hills when other men lit fires to alert me. It was the fire that brought the news, not the gods. Among the gods now there is no one who offers me assistance or oversees my actions or knows my mind. There is no one among the gods to whom I appeal. I live alone in the shivering solitary knowledge that the time of the gods has passed. I'm praying to no gods. I'm alone among those here because I do not pray and will not pray again. Instead, I will speak in ordinary whispers. I will speak in words that come from the world, and those words will be filled with regret for what has been lost. I will make sounds like prayers, but prayers that have no source and no destination, not even a human one, since my daughter is dead and cannot hear. I know, as no one else knows, that the gods are distant. They have other concerns. They care about human desires and antics in the same way that I care about the leaves of a tree. I know the leaves are there. They wither and grow again and wither as people come and live and then are replaced by others like them. There's nothing I can do to help them or prevent their withering. I do not deal with their desires. I wish now to stand here and laugh. Hear me tittering and then howling with mirth at the idea that the gods allowed my husband to win his war, that they inspired every plan he worked out and every move he made, that they knew his cloudy moods in the morning and the strange and silly exhilaration he could exude at night, that they listened to his implorings and discussed them in their godly homes, that they watched the murder of my daughter with approval. The bargain was simple, or so he believed, or so his troops believed. Kill the innocent girl in return for a change in the wind. Take her out of the world. Use a knife on her flesh to ensure that she would never again walk into a room or wake in the morning. Deprive the world of her grace. And as a reward, the gods would make the wind blow in her father's favor on the day he needed wind-free sails. They would hush the wind on the other days when his enemies needed it. The gods would make his men alert and brave and fill his enemies with fear. The gods would strengthen his swords and make them swift and sharp. When he was alive, he and the men around him believed that the gods followed their fates and cared about them, each of them. But I will say now that they did not, they do not. Our appeal to the gods is the same as the appeal a star makes in the sky above us before it falls. It is a sound we cannot hear, a sound to which even if we did hear it, we would be fully indifferent. The gods have their own unearthly concerns, unimagined by us. They barely know we are alive. For them, if they were to hear of us, we would be like the mild sound of wind in the trees, a distant, unpersistent, rustling sound.
You're listening to writer Colm Tobin, whose new novel is House of Names, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I know that it was not always thus. There was a time when the gods came in the morning to wake us, when they combed our hair and filled our mouths with the sweetness of speech, and listened to our desires and tried to fulfill them for us, when they knew our minds and when they could send us signs. Not long ago, within our memories, the crying women could be heard in the night, in the time before death came. It was a way of calling the dying home, hastening their flight, softening their wavering journey to the place of rest. My husband was with me in the days before my mother died, and we both heard it, and my mother heard it too, and it comforted her that death was ready to lure her with its cries. That noise has stopped. There is no more crying like the wind. The dead fade in their own time. No one helps them. No one notices except those who have been close to them during their short spell in the world. As they fade from the earth, the gods do not hover over with their haunting, whistling sound. I notice it here, the silence around death. They have departed, the ones who oversaw death. They have gone, and they will not be back. My husband was lucky with the wind, that was all, and lucky his men were brave, and lucky that he prevailed. It could easily have been otherwise. He did not need to sacrifice our daughter to the gods. My nurse was with me from the time I was born. In her last days, we did not believe that she was dying. I sat with her, and we talked. If there had been the slightest sound of wailing, we would have heard. There was nothing. No sound to accompany her towards death. There was silence or the usual noises from the kitchen or the barking of dogs. And then she died, and then she stopped breathing. It was over for her. I went out and looked at the sky. And all I had then to help me was the leftover language of prayer. What had once been powerful and added meaning to everything was now desolate, strange, with its own sad, brittle power, with its memory locked in its rhythms of a vivid past when our words rose up and found completion. Now our words are trapped in time. They are filled with limits. They are mere distractions. They're as fleeting and monotonous as breath. They keep us alive, and maybe that is something, at least for the moment, for which we should be grateful. There is nothing else. And this idea of working, you know, that I'd seen Electra being performed a number of times, and I had some sense of where Electra's rage came from and where it was going, but this story of her mother from her mother's side was new. But in this story, there's one thing completely missing, and it's missing from everybody's version of the story, from Sophocles, from Aeschylus, from Euripides, and also, there's no Greek scholar I'm aware of who has any explanation for it. Where was Orestes when he was away? In other words, his sister Electra. You know, in other words, Clytemnestra murders her husband. Their daughter, their other daughter, Electra, is in a rage over this, that her mother had no right to do this. And she's just generally in a rage, and she just directs her rage against her mother. And what she's going to do is wait for her brother to return. And when he returns, both of them are going to go and get their mother in retaliation, this spiral of violence within the house of Atreus. And the issue is, where was he? And it's a sort of gift to a novelist, because you can think, well, you know, since there's no source for this, I can do anything with this I want. You know, I can bring him up a mountain, I can bring him into a valley. I can have him alone, I can have him with friends. I can just let my mind loose and put anything into this story that I want to. I mean, I was doing that anyway, actually, with some of the Greek originals. But in the case of this, I began to imagine, there are certain versions in Homer, for example, he's heroic, Orestes. But novels, another thing about the novel is not a good space for heroes. The novel loves weakness. It loves flaws. It loves people who are not up to much. And it loves chancers. It loves losers. And so that in making the figure of Orestes, I was making that idea of a younger brother who has no strategy, somebody who has no plans for anything, who follows and who is very easily led, but actually inside him is a sort of rage, just like his sister. He actually witnessed the sacrifice of his daughter, of his sister, Iphigenia. Sorry, I get this family all mixed up. That he actually witnessed his sister being sacrificed, and he told no one he saw this. And his father went off to war when he was very young, and he was kidnapped later on. So that in him there's a sort of rage. It means in a way he's a funny mixture. There's an inner thug in him, but he doesn't look like that. He looks innocent, so he's all the more dangerous for that. He's a sort of lethal weapon. He's a piece of putty, and anybody can use him for any purpose. But he is kidnapped, and he goes to the equivalent of a sort of... Somebody mentioned to me, who was in the same boarding school as I was in Ireland, the same Catholic boarding school, that said to me, "I see you finally put the school into the book," you know, because he's... He's kidnapped, and he's taken there where other boys who've been kidnapped are. And if only I had thought of it, himself and two other boys escape from the school, and they cross the countryside, and they end up in this house with the sea on three sides, which is has an old woman living in it. And as soon as I started to do some of this, I found that I was using Irish mythology as much as Greek mythology. For example, the woman has three dogs, and they kill the dogs. And they kill the dog. One of the dogs is killed in precisely the way that Cú Chulainn in Irish mythology kills one of the dogs, and which you can read in the Táin. That's T-A-I-N, which is sort of our great single story within Irish mythology. There are various translations. Penguin Classics has a translation by Kieran Carson, but Lady Gregory did a translation at the turn of the 19th and the 20th century, which was a big bestseller of this warrior, Cú Chulainn. And what in my novel, they say to the old woman says, "Well, I have no one to protect me." And the boys say to her, "We will protect you. We will be your dogs," which is exactly what Cú Chulainn says in his story. And in this story, because, of course, Clytemnestra's mother is Leda, and Leda was raped by the god Zeus, who came in the form of a swan, so that the swan in this story is a vital element, or is a very important figure. We have a story in Irish mythology called The Children of Lir, which I think is the most beautiful story we have. And so that I added this story. I was dreaming about this idea of a boat coming from Ireland to somewhere else, you know, say landing in England, and or say going to France, and the story going across France, down into the Mediterranean, across into Greece, very slowly, this Irish story, so that they take it as a story of theirs. And one of the other boys is called Mitros, and they're staying in the house of the old woman. Often at night, Mitros relayed to Orestes the stories that the old woman had told him when he was alone with her. Whispering, he recounted what she had said, trying to remember the exact words, stopping in the same way she did when he came to some of the details. "There was a man, or maybe a king," he said, "who had four children, one girl and three boys. He loved his wife and his children, and they were happy." "When was this?" Orestes asked. "Oh, I don't know," Mitros said. "Anyway, and then the woman died," he continued, "the mother of the four children, and they were sad until their father sent for the sister of their mother, and he married her, and they were happy again until she became jealous of the four children. So she ordered the children to be killed. But the servant she ordered to do the killing said she could not do it because they were beautiful children. And he stopped for a moment as though he'd forgotten the next part. Maybe the king would be angry, Oreste said. Yes, maybe. But then she came to kill them herself when they were sleeping or when they were playing. But when she came to kill them, she was not able. So instead, she turned them into swans. And could they fly? Yes. They flew away. It was part of the spell that they had to fly far away. But before they did, they asked for one thing. They asked for a silver chain so they would never be apart. The chain was made for them and they flew away with the chain between them. But what happened to them? They flew to one place and then to another and then to another, and many years passed. Sometimes it was cold. Did they die? They flew for 900 years. And all the years they waited and talked about going home. They talked about the day when they would fly with the silver chain still between them and they would find the place they came from. When that time came, everyone they had known was dead. There were other people there, people they did not know, new people who were frightened when the swans landed and their wings fell off and then their beaks and then all their feathers fell off and they were people again. They were people, but they were not children anymore. They were 900 years old, and all the new people ran away when they saw them. And what happened then? They died, and then the people who ran away came back and buried them. And the silver chain, did they bury that too? No, the people kept the silver chain, and they sold it later, or they used it for something else. And it was that idea of stories moving back and forth from thousands of years that struck me, that when Orestes goes home now, as he does very soon after this, the piece I've just read, he is a young man. He is uneasy, slightly perplexed. His father has been murdered. His mother has taken a lover, and he's wandering uneasily in a palace. And I realize, Shakespeare. So Shakespeare took this and made it into Hamlet, and. And a part of the thing he did in Hamlet was to mix what was almost a sense of medieval Europe with a sort of modern Europe, with Hamlet as educated and playful and melancholy and ready to change his moods and ready to be decisive or not as he should please. I mean, fully autonomous in his being in the play. But at the same time, he actually believes that his father's ghost has appeared to him and told him something that he needed to know and that had to disappear once the dawn came up. So he's living in two worlds at the same time. And once that occurred to me, I realized that I could make a ghost as well in this book. That if he could do that, I could do this. So there was also a technical problem, which was that Orestes finally, egged on by his sister Electra, actually murders his own mother. And the problem is, what do you do next? I looked back to see what other novelists had done with this, but I couldn't find another novel where anyone had. I mean, it isn't in Jane Austen, I can tell you that, where anyone murdered, or isn't Henry James doesn't try it either. I mean, what do you do that night? Do you have dinner with people or do you sit on your own? And what emotions are going through your mind? And I mean, you know, in other words, obviously, you know what some of those emotions would be. So the reader sort of knows how frightened he is by what he's done himself, how uneasy he is, and almost how proud he is, how many different and ambiguous emotions there are. And the best thing to do sometimes with something like that is to leave it out completely. It's just let the reader imagine it. It is just turn the page to something else. And what I wanted to turn the page to was that his mother, Clytemnestra, has immediately come back as a ghost. But she doesn't remember how she was killed. And she has a sense, some memory somehow, that it occurred in a garden or steps down to a garden. But she's not sure what it was and she doesn't know who did it. And all she's looking for is one more connection in the world to someone who she's known or who she has been close to. And she's also, of course, remembering her mother, who was leader. There will come a time when the shadows fold in on me. I know that. But I'm awake now, or almost awake. I remember some things, outlines come to me in the faint sound of voices. What linger most are traces of people, presences, sounds. Mostly I walk among the shades, but sometimes a hint of someone comes close, someone whose name I once knew, or whose voice and face were real to me. Someone I once loved, perhaps, I am not sure. There's one remnant that comes and persists, however. It is my mother at some moment in the distant past. This is Lida. She's helpless, being held down. I can hear cries, her cries, and the shriller cries of a figure above her or lying on her, and then louder cries as the figure flits away, a figure with a beak and wings, with the shape of wings, the wings beating in the air, and my mother lying breathless, whimpering. But I do not know what this means or why it comes to me. I feel that if I remain still, something more will come. It is hard not to wander in these spaces when there is silence. There are presences I wish to encounter, presences that are close but not close enough to touch or be seen. I cannot think of their names, and I cannot see the faces clearly enough, although there are moments when I have been quiet, when I have made no effort for some time to remember or focus, moments when a face approaches, the face of someone I have known, but it fades before it becomes anyone I can recognize. I know that there was feeling, and that is the difference between where I am now and the place I was once. There was a time, I know, when I felt rage, I felt sorrow, but now I have lost what leads to rage and sorrow. Maybe the only reason I wander in these spaces has to do with some other feeling, or what is left of it. Maybe that feeling is love. There is someone whom I love still, or have loved and protected, but I can't be sure of that. No name will come. Some words come, but not the words I want, which are the names. If I can say the names, I will know then whom I loved, and I will find them or know how to see them. I will lure them into the shadows when the time is right. No one in their world knows how little there is here. It is all blankness, strangeness, silence. Hardly anything moves. There are echoes like distant water flowing under rock. And then sometimes that sound comes nearer, but it is still faint. If I listen too eagerly, it disappears. Maybe there are things that did not come to an end when I was there, and they linger now like words that need to be said, or words that have escaped me and will come or might come or must come as I wait here. It will take time. I do not know how much time I have, or how much time there is, but I know that I must fade, that I cannot persist in this state. The fading will be gradual. By the end, I will not know anything. What I'm hoping for is one more surge, some hours or even moments when I will go back into the world and settle into it briefly as though I were alive. In the meantime, there is memory, which connects and attaches and withdraws. It is almost something. A vague thought hovers but is never stable. Like a figure with wings, it edges towards what has been or was. I live on the inside of what has substance. I can feel some large set of pressing desires brushing past. All I am left with, though, are the grey traces, the clues. This must be what shadow is like, or aftermath. Some lines or shapes that must have made sense at one time, or may still make sense, but seem random now. If only I could follow what their intention was, or whisper to whoever made them. That desire is the closest I have come to pure feeling, and it is not close at all. I'll be left here for the hours or days or years I have been allotted, no longer than that. Being perplexed and bewildered replaces truth and knowledge, replaces what is real and tangible. The space I inhabit is like a sad gift that was offered but will soon be withdrawn. Then a word occurred to me, a word of which I was sure. It was the word dream. Once the word came, I knew what dream was or had been, and I was certain then that I was not dreaming in this nullness, that none of what is happening is dream. It is real. It is actual. And then other words appeared like stars in the darkening sky. I became desperate to take possession of each one, but I could not hold on to them. They were falling or glittering or moving further away. It was enough, however, to have seen them, to get some idea of their power, and know that some of them would return, and like the light from a full moon on a dark night, become part of a shadowy stability that was guiding me. I walked in the corridors of that palace where I had once lived. I could almost remember some things that had happened. There was an image of someone in a garden or on steps that led to a garden, staring hard, breathing hard, but then nothing. Just stillness in the garden. And then there was not even a garden, there was merely a space. But I was still awake. I was waiting, knowing that there would be change, that it would not always be like this. I was aware how easy it would be once I was in those corridors again for one of the guards to notice me if I made a sound or if I moved quickly so that there would be some disturbance in the air. And then slowly I began to understand why I was here and who I was looking for. His name did not come to me and I was not able to picture his face, but I felt that he was close.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features writer Colm Tobin, whose new novel is House of Names. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I could imagine the guard who had seen me or who had noticed my presence consulting one of the other guards and then both of them approaching him, the one I'm searching for, or his friend who looks after him. My husband is dead and my daughter, they have become pure shade. My other daughter is here, but the one I'm searching for is my son. I am awake, the words I knew are sleeping. Sometimes they turn in the night or make some sound in their vast dreaming, and then they wake too. Often, if only for a second, they open their eyes and watch me. I hold their gaze so that they might remember me as they fall back into sleep. I study them then in their inert state. I'm alert to any movement they make. I can hear their dark groanings in the night, intermittent against their breathing. I can see them reach their arms towards me to be lifted. I can tell the difference between night and day now. I know the silence that descends on the gardens and corridors at night, a silence broken only by the soft movements of the guards or of cats. This is my realm where I'm free to wander. As I come from the garden, I'm aware that the guards can feel a movement in the air. It would just take one more thing to let them know that I'm with them, a sound, a darting gesture. When the time came, I knew that I would hear his name, my son's name, enough to whisper it, like someone imploring. It would come to me when I needed it. Orestes, I whispered on one of those nights, and then I withdrew into the shadows. Orestes, I repeated, letting my voice echo down the corridor. I saw two of the guards running back and forth and then summoning the other one, my son's friend, who strutted up and down, checking doorways and corners. I waited until he had gone, and then I whispered to one of the guards, "Tell Orestes that I'm his mother. He must come alone into the corridor. He must be alone." The guard made as though to run, but then stopped himself. "Speak again," he said quietly, his head bowed. "Tell Orestes to come alone," I said. "Now?" he asked. "Soon. Orestes must come soon." "Do you mean to cause him harm?" "No, I do not mean to cause him harm." Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about why you chose to write Orestes in the third person and the two women in the first person.
Because he has no voice, while the other two are in full possession of the facts that Clytemnestra knows her own rage and knows why her rage is there, and she needs to describe, and she knows how to describe exactly what happened to her, thus to cause, to cause then those feelings in her. so that she has, she's in full possession of herself. Electra too, even in a more minor way, actually is filled also with a sort of strategy and agency. And she's absolutely there. The poor boy in the middle of them is almost nobody. He's shadow. He has no, as I said, strategy. And so that if he spoke, it would be disjointed. It would be some things he had noticed, which would not necessarily be the things that were important. When the other two notice something, it's exactly what they need to notice. In other words, if Orestes hears someone's whispering, he doesn't know what they're saying. But when his mother or his sister hears someone whispering, they can decipher everything, work everything out. So also, after the first 70 pages, written in that heightened tone, part of the, I suppose the reason for that at the beginning is that with those Greek texts, such as, for example, Medea, Electra, and Antigone, what you get is a sort of out of powerlessness. By virtue of speech, you get power, as though someone who has been silent or crushed or submerged gets to speak only once in a theatrical space, say. The audience has to pay attention because they might not speak again. Thus, the speech patterns are filled with texture. Whereas when the men speak, when Creon speaks in Antigone, for example, it sounds as dry as legislation. But when Antigone speaks, you cannot take your eyes from her because what she's saying is has such fire in it. And the problem with that is that you can only keep it going for as long as a reader can keep going in one sitting. That it's as though somebody is speaking just once, and you have to create the illusion that it was done in real time to be read in real time. You can keep that going for about 20,000. I mean, 20,000 words is about as much as the reader will be able to take of that without actually thinking, this is actually too much coming at me. I have to stop now. And you don't want that. So the thing to do then is to stop it. And almost as though you're working with, say, an orchestra, just to say, we're now going to move into a slow movement. And the slow movement might be taken over even in full by a single instrument, that you move from the full orchestra to a piano sound. And you need to vary the tone and the texture. I mean, just as well as the idea that psychologically, I cannot get a sound for Orestes should he speak, because he will notice the wrong thing. And I can, you know, I would need William Faulkner on one side of me, and I don't quite know who at the other, to get the whole thing going where everything he would tell you would be misleading you and where it would be misleading him. So by bringing him into the third person, I can tell you what he sees, what he notices, what he remembers. And out of that, I'm building a character for him. But if he decides to tell you this himself, he will tell you the wrong thing. He won't have a narrative of himself, as his mother and sister do. So that was the reason I did that.
I certainly heard your reworking of Agamemnon and the libation bearers. I'm guessing that you left the third part of the trilogy, the Eumenides, out because too many gods and furies. Also that trial doesn't kind of fly in the modern sensibility, yeah, when the central argument comes down to a man's, yeah, life is worth more than a father's life, being a male is worth more than a mother's life.
I mean, I had to put a lot of thought into that, because you can't just leave it out. You know, in other words, he murders his mother, and in the original version, the Furies come after him, as it were, and the trial begins. So what I decided to do was to bring that down, instead of the Furies being noisy, to bring it down to the fact that nobody wants him near them. His sister doesn't want him near her. He's served his purpose. His best friend, Leander, doesn't want to see him again, or doesn't want to be near him. The elders, the people who are, as it were, the jury, don't want him in the room. And so that his solitary nature becomes actually very lonely, you know, so that instead of all the noise of the Furies, it goes down to the other business of that the Furies come in the form of silence, in the form of leaving him sadder and more undermined than he was before. But the elders are there, and 12 get mentioned at one point, so that the jury is almost there, and the jury has decided well before that all they want is this boy who murdered his mother to be kept away from them, out of the room. And then, with the whole strange business at the end of the Oresteia, where it's decided that because you know, a mother's life is not valuable here because really she was just the vessel for the seed of the man, and therefore murdering your mother is not like murdering your father, because really she's not quite she's not that important here. What I did with that was I played with it so that when Orestes thinks he has made Leander's sister, that Leander's sister is pregnant by him, she's able to tell him that actually it isn't him. And so that's just a game I'm playing with, that tiny image. I'm just turning it right around. So that's what I did with that. I mean, I think for anyone, even working in the theatre, that's the hardest thing to enact, to work all that out from the drama of this family, to bring it down to the Furies. But what I did with the novel was I just simply kept trying to find images that reflected it or that refracted it or that did something with it. But I didn't, but I brought them down to almost within something that things were happening in him, just to make him more lonely, really was what I did.
Before I read the book, I felt obliged to go back and get familiar with the story again. So I was wondering, when you conceived of the book and as you were writing it, were you expecting people to be familiar with the story or hoping they were familiar with the, you know, not just the vague outlines, but pretty a lot of detail of the story?
Yeah. I've been through this once before with Henry James, where I wrote a novel called The Master about Henry James. And what I was concerned about would be, actually, there were a dwindling number of people who had any interest in Henry James at the time I wrote that book, and a dwindling number of people who had even read, you know, say, his later novels. So what I had to think about was, this is for anyone who is interested in reading a novel about a man who is in England in exile. And you don't have to know anything about his books to read this novel, to follow his story. There are little jokes and little things, if you do know, because he's building up to writing The Ambassador's Wings of the Dove, The Golden Bowl. You know, he hasn't written those books yet, so you can see if you've read those books. There are little clues put in, but they don't matter. I mean, what matters is that I'm concentrating on this spirit, on this character, building him up. And with this book, it's exactly the same, where if you've never heard of this story, you can open this book. And what I was planning, in any case, I have no idea whether I've succeeded or not, but I'm planning that the characters take over and that you don't have to go to the originals and think, oh my God, my parents didn't send me to school enough, you know, that I don't know this story and that I didn't do classics, but that you actually just tell the story without actually having that it's not, in other words, it's not just for a few people who know this story to read, and that it's actually for anyone who reads a novel to read.
When did you read these plays, and when did you think of writing this?
I've always had. I saw. Let me think. Quite late. I mean, you know, I remember seeing an extraordinary production of Electra I'm going to get her name wrong. Claire Bloom playing Clytemnestra, and it was translated by the Irish playwright Frank McGuinness, who's a friend of mine, and I saw it in New York, and I was intensely moved by it. And by that time, I also knew the Richard Strauss version, but it was too wild for me, you know, the music sometimes. And then because I wrote a novel called The Blackwater Lightship, which is really about a daughter's intense hatred for her mother, which really makes no sense, I really went back over the Electra stories, just looking and looking and looking. And I remember even dedicating the book to someone and saying, here's my Electra of the southeast of Ireland. But I didn't. But and there are little clues again in that book from Electra, but again, no one has ever noticed them. I mean, I did read all the reviews of that book, and no one saw this. I was sort of delighted because I thought, you know, I've actually done this without overdoing it. But so that story was always on my mind. I felt I knew that story. What happened with this was that the stories I didn't know, the idea of everything seen from the mother's perspective, you know, which was the Lady Euripides play that I mentioned earlier on, and the Orestes part. So, and what happened was then that some of it came very, very quickly. That last section I read where she's a ghost, I wrote that in a day. And I wrote that in a day in a sort of trance, where whatever was going on, that it was as though bits of this story were, I'm not saying where it's sort of there already, but that it's very, very powerful, this story. And I can see why it's been translated so many times. Particularly at the moment in London, for some particular reason, and considering the English are so mild in general, I mean, Brexit, it's just a mild thing they're doing. And they're generally mild in their habits, the English. But I think there have been 4 Orestias performed in London in the last 2 years. And there's another one going to the Edinburgh Festival, and they're just Orestia crazy at the moment. And luckily, I saw none of those productions. But that what's interesting is actors love them, translators love them, because they're so powerful, visceral, and organically dramatic. So that once you start in with it, it is as though the story can take you, and you can really work with it, and you can start seeing the characters very, very clearly, even though they're thousands of years old, and even though you're working from a translation, and even though you're working, I think most importantly, from a dramatic text rather than from, say, a narrative text. And so it came as a big surprise. I mean, I thought I was going to write another melancholy Irish novel.
Well, I think that's a great note for us to end the evening.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was writer Colm Tobin, whose new novel is House of Names. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.